Well, here we are, 2 weeks into 2013, into the new year. How many of you have participated in that age-old tradition of setting some kind of New Year's resolution? Maybe a few folks. Oh, quite a few people. Great, yeah. And how many of you have also participated in the just-as-old tradition of already breaking that resolution? Few more. Oh, yeah. Even a few more hands, I think, went up. So the beginning of the new year is a momentous occasion. It can be a time when we give up bad habits and take up newer, healthier ones, going to the gym more often or meditating more often, drinking less coffee, taking up a new hobby of some sort to enrich our lives. This drive towards self-improvement is so rooted in our Western culture, isn't it? The dawning of the new year is one occasion when it is in our collective consciousness that we can resolve to make ourselves better in some way. But the urge to improve ourselves is, in ways that are both big and small, is almost constant. In our own kitchen, on our refrigerator, we have a set of fill-in-the-blank magnets that a friend had given to us. And they say things like, eat more fill-in-the-blank, something healthy, clearly, and eat less, whatever it's going to be. I even have a sticker that I picked up at a farmer's market that says, eat more kale. So these prompts to self-improve are all around us. Now, taking stock of how we're living our lives and how we might want to live more in line with our values can be a meaningful activity. I definitely see that. However, I believe that too often the root motivation for self-improvement projects is this belief: I am not enough. I am not skinny enough. I am not smart enough. I am not organized enough. I came across this cartoon, and it shows two angels who are standing on a cloud. The cloud is labeled cloud number 8. And one of them is saying to the other, well, yes, I am happy, but I could be happier. I am not happy enough could be added to the list. Our drive towards making ourselves better in all these different ways can often cloak a fundamental belief in our deficiency, a feeling that we are less than. Now, the first of our 7 Unitarian Universalist principles states that we affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person, regardless of race, class, sexual orientation. We recognize in each other the basic goodness that is at the root of who we are. This principle is at the heart of many of our justice initiatives, our fight for marriage equality, our work towards immigrant rights. And it is commendable the ways that we Unitarian Universalists constantly are pushing forward to make this first principle a lived reality for all peoples. Yet it is my belief that it is often easier for us to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of others even before ourselves. We open our hearts to embracing the goodness of those around us without fully embracing our fundamental goodness. The most common way that this shows up is in the judgments of ourselves that we carry around with us. I have shared with you all that I spent a summer training in a hospital as a hospital chaplain. And my regular assignment was to the neurology and stroke unit in that hospital. One day, another chaplain referred me to a patient who had been assigned to my floor just a few days prior. This patient was younger than most of the others on the unit. He was only in his 40s. He was an employee of the hospital with a young family, and he had had a sudden stroke. Now, I was just learning all of the various ways that having a stroke can affect your neurological capabilities, especially with communication. And I went to visit this man in his hospital room, and as I entered the room, I noticed all of the cards and the flowers, just the outpourings of love, and pictures of his young daughter. And as I began the conversation with him, it became apparent that he was still struggling to regain his speech. And the injustice of his situation just struck me. Here was someone whose life had been changed in an instant. And as I began to converse with him, asking the typical questions that I do of, is it all right to visit and how are you feeling, he could barely get out any words. With painfully, he could say only, I'm sorry, repeatedly. And I thought I would make things easier for him and just ask him some yes or no questions. But still, all he could say was, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. After about 10 minutes, his frustration clearly mounting, he was able to finally get the words out, you can leave. You can leave. It is hard to express the level of inadequacy that I, and I'm sure he, felt in that situation. About a week later, I met with the group of summer chaplains for one of our regular times of reflection. And it wasn't until then, until I shared with them this story of that visit, and the floodgates of tears, wave upon wave of tears, just burst forward. It wasn't until then that I realized I had been holding this failure against myself that entire time. Our desire to be good or helpful, to project security, or to show others we have it all together can drive us towards sometimes subconscious self-critique and judgment. We are talking about mindfulness this month. It comes from the tradition of Buddhism. And Buddhism teaches that we suffer when we see ourselves as separate from other living beings and as separate from our very selves. Tara Brach, a renowned psychologist and teacher of Buddhist mindfulness, calls this particular separation from ourselves, in which we become fixated on our imperfections, the trance of unworthiness. The trance of unworthiness. When we are in this trance, we experience our lives through a lens of personal insufficiency. This can play itself out as perfectionism or avoiding the risk of failure or turning our judgment upon others. And the roots of this trance can go deep. This basic sense of not measuring up is reinforced by our cultural drive to prove over and over again that we are worthy. And our fears and insecurities can be passed down from generation to generation. While I was writing this very sermon, my mother called. She lives in California and has been viewing some of my sermons online, which I appreciate very much. And she asked what I was doing, and I told her that I was writing my upcoming sermon. Well, you know, she said, I was just watching last month's sermon, and if I could offer some advice. I didn't even need to hear the words that came next. I could feel my body tighten up as I was bracing myself for some form of criticism. The suffering caused by this belief in our inadequacy can show up in subtle ways just like that. you're talking with a friend about an artistic endeavor she is about to set out upon, and it triggers you to chide yourself for not being more on the ball with your own projects. Or a coworker shares with you that his family is going to take a weekend to get away and go on a lovely camping trip, and you lament that you never have the time for such things. Often these thoughts of not quite living up don't just stay in our heads, but manifest in how we treat others. When my mental tally sheet of all the things I have failed to get done in a day gets long, one of the habits I can fall into is turning my criticism onto my husband's driving. You're going too fast, you're going too slow, you're following that car too closely. Why did you go this way home? It's so much faster to go that other way. I'm sure none of you have experienced this. You may have your own examples of how when you judge yourself harshly, this can lead you to treat others in ways that you would rather not. The spiritual practice of mindfulness can help us to loosen this grip of the trance of unworthiness and instead help us embrace our goodness. Many of us are familiar with the spiritual practice of mindfulness. Reverend Kent led our children in an exercise of mindfulness just a few minutes ago. And mindfulness is a way of slowing down, of paying attention, and being present to what is before us now. Just like the children did with that raisin. Meditation is another form of mindfulness, and one that is most often associated with that word, mindfulness. Sometimes meditation is characterized as a clearing away of thoughts. And the mind part of mindfulness naturally draws our attention to up here, to this part of ourselves. However, in many Asian languages, the word for mind and the word for heart are one and the same. This can be difficult for our Western brains to wrap our heads around, but I invite you to consider that, the concept of our mind and our heart being one and the same. So we might translate the word mindfulness to heartfulness and see what happens, how that shifts our understanding of the word or opens up some new way of understanding it. The doctor and writer Jon Kabat-Zinn describes mindfulness as awakefulness. It is a state of being awake through the whole of our beings, becoming aware of our bodies, of our thoughts, of our emotions, in this moment, in this space, becoming awareness itself. After I shared that story of my visit with my fellow chaplains, I took some time alone. I went off into the parking lot behind our building to take a walk and found a small patch of grass that I could just sit down on and reflect. And I sat down feeling overwhelmed by sadness and grief. And as each emotion came up and each label, I just felt it, noticed it, and said yes, and this too. Failure. Yes, I feel like a failure. Shame. Yes. Doubt. Yes. And slowly my heart softened, and I could feel a gentleness, a kindness toward myself. Through mindfulness, heartfulness, awakefulness, we can learn to hold ourselves in kindness. Creating the space for awareness is something we each can do at any moment. It may simply be while you're standing in a line at the grocery store that's way too long. Pause. Impatience. Pause. Worry. or when you receive an email at work that especially pushes your buttons. That also never happens. Pause. Irritation. The act of simply pausing and bringing our attention to what is present in us is an act of kindness. We are saying, I see myself clearly, and I hold myself with love. Derek Walcott writes, the time will come when with elation you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror, and each will smile at each other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image of yourself from the mirror. Sit. Feast on your life. Can you greet yourself arriving at your own door? Can you accept that you, at your core, are goodness itself? Some of you may be wondering, why is Joan asking us to spend so much time focused on ourselves? Isn't this just another form of self-help or some kind of narcissistic indulgence? No. For me, embracing our goodness has direct and profound effects on how we treat others in our personal lives, how willing we are to take up the call for social action. Embracing our goodness affects the ways that we enact our love in the world. As Tara Brach writes, when we are not consumed by blaming and turning on ourselves or others, we are free to cultivate our talents and gifts together, to contribute them to the world in service. We are free to love each other and the whole of life without holding back. We are free to love without holding back. In their book, Made for Goodness, Archbishop Desmond Tutu and his daughter, Po, share a story of love without holding back. They met a woman named Mrs. Maposila, who lives in a black township outside of Cape Town in South Africa. And one day, many years ago, Mrs. Maposila saw a child on the street who was alone, late at night, at a time when no child should be alone on the street. And she asked the child, where is your mother? And the child said, she is sick. So Mrs. Maposila offered her some food. And then the day after, and the day after that, the child returned. And it turned out that the child's mother was infected with HIV, not uncommon in that area. And as the mother was approaching her death, she asked Mrs. Maposila to take care of her child, to take her in. She did, and word spread, and others did the same, asking Mrs. Maposila, can you take my child, or just simply leaving the child at the doorstep. When the Tutus met her, she was living in a three-room house with a corrugated iron roof. And she was taking care of 20 children from the ages of 8 months old to 21 years old. They would have to bring out pallets at night to sleep on. The boys would gather theirs together in the kitchen and the girls in the bedroom with Mrs. Maposila. And she had volunteers who would come into the house, women who were just as poor as she was, to cook and clean and do the laundry. And according to the Tutus, what was so striking at Mrs. Maposila's house was how obvious it was that these children were loved and that they loved her in turn. We are all free to embrace our goodness and to love without holding back. May it be so for us in the new year and always.